It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, when's the last time you cried during a movie? We'll talk to a film expert about what movies can move us to tears, and we'll ask you to share a movie that's made you cry. First, it's been a big week for infrastructure. On Tuesday, a group of Republican and Democratic senators approved a bipartisan infrastructure package. And Democrats in the Senate approved an outline for their $3.5 trillion package that would fund things like free community college and child care. It's the week in Washington. We'll talk about that and some big political news right here in Wisconsin. Democratic U.S. Representative Ron Kind announced yesterday he will not be running for re-election in Western Wisconsin's 3rd District, a seat he's held since 1997. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to Representative Ron Kind's retirement? If you live in the 3rd Congressional District, what have you thought about his leadership over the last two decades? Are you looking forward to new congressional representation in that district? You're a close district in political terms, one of the few ones in the country. Are you looking forward to all the attention? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. She joins us for a look at Kind's announcement. Laurel, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a listen to some of what Representative Kind had to say about why he's retiring. Here he is at that press conference in La Crosse yesterday.
The truth is, I've run out of gas. At the end of this term, it'll be 26 years of running back and forth to Washington, D.C., of traveling around, in my humble opinion, the most beautiful congressional district in the nation, the 3rd Congressional District.
Can you talk a little more about what Representative Kind said about his decision not to run again?
Well, I think that was a big part of it, Rob. You know, he talked about how he's run out of gas. He talked about how, you know, it's a demanding job. He has kept his home base in La Crosse all this time. His family is there. So a lot of commuting back and forth between Washington and Wisconsin. But, you know, he also talked about kind of the type of politician that he's tried to be. He characterized himself, as he has for years, as a moderate. And when he spoke about that yesterday, he said that he believes he's part of a, quote, dying breed of public servants that kind of try to find compromise and bipartisan solutions for things. So though he didn't say it outright, you know, he said, I'm tired, I've run out of gas. He also kind of alluded to the fact that the political climate is different than it was when he first got into office.
This is Wisconsin's most competitive congressional district right now, arguably Wisconsin's only competitive congressional district right now. Can you remind us of the results we've seen there in the last couple few elections?
This is such an interesting district, Rob. I think political experts and watchers alike really enjoy kind of nerding out on this district, some of the choices that it's made over the years. So just to kind of give you a run of recent presidential elections in the 3rd District, Barack Obama won the district by 11 points in 2012. So pretty decisive victory for Obama then. But then President Trump went on to win the district in 2016 and again in 2020 by about 4 points in each of those elections. But of course, as President Trump won, in those elections, Ron Kind was still reelected as a Democratic congressperson. So we've certainly seen kind of the flip there and then the close divides where we've had people voting for Trump and Kind on the same ticket.
Laurel, it's been a pastime in Wisconsin whenever there's a need for a Democratic candidate for statewide office, governor or U.S. senator. Speculation about, is this going to be Ron Kind's year to do that on a statewide basis? And people are still wondering about that maybe for the Senate next year. But I don't know. If I was going to run for another office, I don't know if I'd start by saying I'm running out of gas.
Right. I think if he was going to do that, we probably would have gotten a little bit of a hint of that yesterday. You're absolutely right that I feel like every conversation that we have about Democratic candidates for a statewide office in Wisconsin before Ron Kind rules it out, and he usually doesn't quickly. Usually he says that he's thinking about it or hasn't ruled it out when folks ask him about this stuff. I think that's because he is from such an interesting district for Democrats. He comes from a part of the state that isn't considered kind of a progressive hotbed. You know, he's not from Madison. He's not from Milwaukee. He brings a different perspective for a statewide, you know, Democratic candidate. So that's been attractive to some folks. But obviously, he hasn't decided to do that up until this point. And it seems pretty unlikely for the future.
Laurel, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. She talked to us about Democrat Ron Kind's decision not to run for re-election in 2022. For more on the national impact of Kind's announcement and other top stories in Washington this week, we'll turn to Andy Duren. He covers Congress and American politics for the Wall Street Journal. Andy, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
Andy, this is big news. Ron Kind saying he's not running again. Big news in Wisconsin. Is it being treated as big news on the national scene as well?
It's definitely seen as in Washington as part of a trend of some Democrats, House Democrats in some of these competitive districts who are opting not to run for re-election ahead of the 2022 midterm. Just for context right now, Democrats in the House have an extraordinarily narrow margin. And given that this is a midterm election in the first midterm election of a Democratic president's term, usually historically, that first midterm election will go to the advantage of the opposition party, in this case, Republicans. So Democrats are very much bracing for a very difficult battle to hold on to their majority in the House in 2022. And some of these exits from folks like Ron Kind are in Washington interpreted as a signal that folks are not necessarily confident that they'll be able to win those races and that Democrats may not be able to keep the majority after next year. So that's kind of the context that it's playing out here in Washington. And it's part of kind of the broader, the broader battle for the control of the House of Representatives in 2022.
A lot of House seats, Andy, around the country are pretty safe for one party or the other. Do you expect to see a lot of money get thrown into something like Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, given that we actually have seen close races in recent years?
I'm sure that district will be one of many that where both sides pour a lot of resources and time and effort into over the next several months. I mean, I think, you know, part of it will depend on, who the Democratic candidate ultimately is and how competitive that person is seen as being against the Republican candidate and all sorts of, you know, different factors that, you know, national parties consider when they make these decisions about resource allocation. But, you know, certainly it can be expected that, a district like that that's been, you know, competitive in presidential races and in congressional races in the last few years will be one where, you know, both parties gear up for a serious contest.
Talking to Andy Duren from the Wall Street Journal. It's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics, some of it here in Wisconsin this week. Moving on to infrastructure now, you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the Senate vote, giving the go-ahead to one of the two big infrastructure deals out there. Let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to President Biden celebrating that Senate vote yesterday. Here's a listen to what he said at the White House after the vote.
After years and years of infrastructure week, we're in the cusp of an infrastructure decade that I truly believe will transform America.
Andy, can you talk about what happened yesterday in the Senate, why it's a big deal?
So yesterday, the Senate passed a roughly $1 trillion infrastructure bill that was the product of months of negotiations between a group of 10 senators, 5 Republicans and 5 Democrats, and then the White House. And as President Biden alluded to in his remarks there, this is a big deal for a couple of different reasons. I mean, one is obviously just kind of the policy accomplishment at the center of this. You know, infrastructure is something that, you know, members of both parties have recognized, you know, this is an area that Congress should tackle, that there's an underlying need to, you know, pour a lot of money into roads, bridges, and, you know, other things like water infrastructure and broadband internet. But then it's also a vindication for folks like President Biden and also moderate lawmakers in both parties that, bipartisan progress on major issues is something that's possible. It is something that can be accomplished. So for both of those reasons, yesterday was a big day in the Senate for for the Republicans involved in this agreement, for the Democrats involved in it, and then also for the White House.
And as you pointed out in a tweet, both Senators Mitch McConnell and Bernie Sanders voted on the same side on this. What does that tell you about support for this thing?
Yeah, so this it did, you know, a big bipartisan agreement like this. It had all 50 Democrats, including, or all 50 members of the Democratic caucus, including Bernie Sanders. And then Mitch McConnell was one of the 19 Republicans who did vote in favor of this. And I think, you know, it highlights, you know, both the work that, you know, the folks did in negotiating this agreement, but also, you know, points to the fact that infrastructure is probably unique as an issue where there is kind of a general bipartisan support for addressing it. I mean, putting federal resources into, you know, dams and airports and things like that is something that's pretty comparatively straightforward on a policy level as opposed to healthcare or taxes. And so it is a topic that is something that, you know, lawmakers of a lot of different stripes are find themselves more easily unifying around versus some of those more challenging policy areas.
We're talking to Andy Duren. He covers Congress and American politics at The Wall Street Journal. He is with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you happy to see this bipartisan infrastructure bill pass the Senate? Football's not being spiked just yet. There's still the House and the other infrastructure bill, the possibly Democratic-only infrastructure bill. Call in with your reactions, thoughts, hopes, dreams, fears, and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at the top stories in national politics. Andy Duren stays with us from the Wall Street Journal. We're going to stick with infrastructure now, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. If this thing passes and the money comes to Wisconsin, what would you want to see infrastructure spending go toward here in the state? What's at the top of your infrastructure agenda, if you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Andy, this thing passed the Senate. Now there's the House, and I understand there's some differences among Democrats, not so much whether they want to vote for it or not, but whether they're going to vote for it without a commitment for the Senate on the other infrastructure thing. What's going on?
Yes, that's right. The fate of the infrastructure bill in the House is intertwined with the fate of this other separate package that's focused on a whole range of issues. That's education, that's healthcare, that's climate change, that Democrats are also pushing for as part of advancing President Biden's agenda on Capitol Hill. So right now there's kind of a standoff where House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said that she will not bring up the infrastructure bill in the House until the Senate also passes that separate piece of legislation, which could cost as much as $3.5 trillion. And she's doing that because there's a pretty large group of progressives in the House who are nervous that without that assurance that the Senate would not move forward with that other set of priorities, and they want to basically hold the infrastructure bill hostage until they have proof or they have a result from the Senate, and they know that these other priorities will also be addressed this year. So as you can tell, there's a lot of different factors and a lot of kind of interlocking things here that have gone into what could be basically a months-long wait until we actually see the infrastructure bill, which is not expected to change substantially in the House. But it still might not pass the House for a while Democrats figure out this whole other package, which, you know, involves a whole bunch of different complicated policy decisions and policy designs that they'll have to work out among themselves over the coming weeks and months.
All right. So some legislative table tennis here. Let's bounce back over to the Senate side. This Democrat only bigger, looser definition of infrastructure bill. What's going on with that on the Senate side of things now?
So the Senate has formally started the process of writing that bill. Like you mentioned, this is a piece of legislation that Democrats are expecting and are planning on passing without any Republican support. And so to do that, they have to use a kind of special legislative procedure that requires a little bit more preparation and time. So they've formally begun that process, and now they will actually sit down and try and write some of the specifics of this legislation. And so that is figuring out exactly, you know, how long to, you know, extend an expanded child tax credit that has started going out into bank accounts for many Americans. How long to design some of these healthcare programs and exchange subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, or extending or expanding Medicare to cover dental, hearing, and vision care. So there's just a lot of, you know, big policy questions they have to tackle. You know, I haven't even mentioned, you know, they're trying to raise taxes on corporations and change how capital gains are taxed, and a whole bunch of different questions that they now have to kind of sit down and kind of try and put pen to paper and write out solutions that will get the support of all 50 Democrats in the Senate. And that is no easy task. It's something that, you know, just earlier today, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said was going to be pretty difficult. And they're expecting this to be a hard, legislative process, just given the breadth and the depth of the issues that they want to tackle. And so that will be, you know, kind of the next phase there in the Senate.
We are talking to Andy Duren from the Wall Street Journal. He covers Congress and American politics there. It's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. You can weigh in with your thoughts on infrastructure. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Looks like a little glitch on the phone line there. So send us an email with your thoughts quickly. Ideas@WPR.org is the place to send that to us. Andy, with the more likely smaller infrastructure bill, I understand there was a Votorama, I don't know how people pronounce it, in the Senate yesterday. I'm guessing that was way less exciting than the word sounds. What is that?
So overnight last night, the Senate had a Votorama, and this was actually a Votorama that led up to the passage of kind of the budget blueprint for the $3.5 trillion broader Democrat-only bill. And so that was because of this special process Democrats are using. They have to do this this Votorama because there's no limit on the number of amendments that Republicans or lawmakers of both parties can offer as part of that process. And so what that ends up producing is primarily members of the opposition party put out a bunch of different amendments on issues that they think will kind of trap or put the other party in a difficult position. In the form that took last night, that was Republicans offering amendments on, you know, things related to taxes, on things related to abortion, places where they wanted to try and put Democrats in a tough spot or split Democrats. It's important to keep in mind, though, that these amendment votes on the Votorama that happened yesterday and earlier today, they are for the most part meaningless in terms of policy consequences. These are amendments that are often written in a way to a document that is just a budget resolution, such that even when they're passed, they do not have the force of law or any, you know, consequences in terms of public policy. But they can highlight some kind of interesting political divisions, in this case among Democrats, and maybe give some hints at where some of these policy debates will go in the future. But for the most part, it's a relic of kind of just the strange rules that the Senate uses and that Democrats are using to try and pass legislation with just a simple majority rather than the typical 60 vote majority that you need to overcome a filibuster in the Senate.
Andy, as I mentioned earlier, nobody's spiking the football on either infrastructure deal yet. There's still some work to do before they get done. And I won't ask you to predict the future, but what is the sense in Congress of whether either or both of these is actually going to get passed?
I think right now there is, my expectation would be that eventually we will see the infrastructure bill, largely as it was approved in the Senate, become law, and that there will be some sort of additional package of Democratic priorities that also eventually works its way through both chambers of Congress. I think, you know, there could be it's reasonable to expect that there will be changes to what exactly Democrats are looking at now. I mean, you've already had some folks like Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia just this morning. He's a Democrat. He said that $3.5 trillion was too much money and that he was uncomfortable with spending that much money. And so there might be some changes to the overall size of the package and, you know, what some of the policy provisions that are in there might have to come out for various reasons. But I think, right now, Democrats see this as, you know, basically their primary opportunity to enact policy changes on, you know, a whole laundry list of party priorities while they control the government. And, you know, they're looking at the 2022 midterms and they see that, you know, it's possible or, you know, history would suggest that they will probably lose control of the House. And so this is really their window to make progress on a whole lot of issues that folks in the party have wanted to make progress on for a decade, you know, going back to the last time that Democrats controlled the White House, House and Senate. And so I think it's unlikely that, you know, they won't be able to figure out a way to do something on some of those issues. I think, you know, total failure is a pretty unlikely outcome. Just if I were, you know, putting probabilities in all of this, I'm not saying it's impossible, but I don't think they'll just, you know, pack up and go home and not pass anything on all of these issues that they have worked on for literally a decade.
And Andy, as we wrap up, that's infrastructure, a big story right now. What do you have your eyes on in other stories over the next week or two?
You know, really, it's going to be, you know, my world really does revolve around these two big policy issues. I mean, it'll be interesting to see, you know, just what some of the jockeying is among the various, you know, parties, you know, the various wings of the Democratic Party on these issues in the next few weeks. And if we do start to see, you know, some of these specific policy issues develop with more specificity. But, you know, August, especially on a non-election year like we are right now in Washington, you know, August is considered a kind of slow month. So it will be kind of a slow boil for a while on these issues and a whole lot of others. I think, you know, a lot of folks in Washington are ready for that after the sprint we've all been through the last few weeks. But those will be the main things that I continue to keep my eye on.
Andy, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Andy Duren. He covers Congress and American politics for the Wall Street Journal. He was with us today for our weekly look at the top stories in national news. Coming up after news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. When it comes to movies, are you a crybaby? No judgment. There's nothing wrong with that. We'll talk about the experience of crying while viewing, and we'll ask you to share the movies you've cried along to. You can get us started right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. There aren't a lot of times where you can cry in public with strangers around and not be worried about getting some strange looks. Movies offer that and more. You might not even be alone in crying. We asked our Wisconsin Public Media colleagues for movies they've cried to. Larry Mueller Show producer Jill Nato told us there are a number of them, but Up has to be the one that comes to mind first. The brilliance of the montage in the beginning without any words and as animation. Jill says, I'm a wreck every time. Even though I know it's going to happen. A little music from Up there to kick us off. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a movie that reliably makes you cry? Do you enjoy the experience of crying at movies? In a theater, at home, on a plane? Is there a certain type of movie that gets you every time? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is an associate professor of English and Film Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She wrote the book The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship and Modernized American Theater Architecture. Jocelyn, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob. I always love being on.
Love having you on, Jocelyn. And I understand you are a fan of communal crying in a movie theater where we can go to the theaters. What is it about crying at a movie that's, I don't know, good?
Well, that sure makes me sound weird, Rob. But
well, no, you're not the only one.
I know. It is actually a real delight of mine. One of my favorite things to do, and this has been true for a very long time, is to go to a matinee of a movie that I know is going to make me cry by myself, so that I can sit by myself and cry and, you know, get it all out without having to talk to anybody about it. But I know that I'm also having that emotional catharsis with others around me. There's no other artistic experience like that.
Is there a movie or a type of movie that gets you, Jocelyn?
Well, I'm a huge crybaby. When it comes to movies, it's a little funny because my job is certainly to look at films critically, but I am completely emotionally manipulated by films. So there's any number of films that really get me. But one of the more recent ones that has just absolutely wrecked me is this very beautiful film by Christopher Makoto Yogi, who's a Hawaiian filmmaker, called I Was a Simple Man. And it's about this older man coming to terms with the moment of his death, and all of these ghosts are coming back to see him. It's just really, I'm going to cry just thinking about it.
Oh. Well, I had a hard time thinking of particular movies, not because I'm Johnny Tough Guy and I never cry at movies, but because I'm such a sap. It's like so easy that like me tearing up a movie, I don't even register it really anymore. One I did think of is The Constant Gardener, based on a John le Carré book, strangely, but there's a scene where a kid's being abducted to be a child soldier, and something about the reality of that. That's one I prominently remember crying at a theater for. I don't know. Are there things like, oh, that seems so real, it makes me cry, or this is such a happy, fantastic fantasy romance thing? It seems like there's such a wide range, Jocelyn, of things that can make us cry.
There's such a wide range. And I think that's a really great point, Rob, because that's one of the things that will make me cry too, is when some scene or aspect or theme of the film really brings to mind some deeper social mm-hmm. issue that maybe we feel a bit powerless to combat, right? And we're crying at the fact that we feel powerless in the wake of all of these sorts of social structures and problems that seem absolutely impossible for us to solve. And so I think that's an example of that. There's a film, Leave No Trace, the Deborah Granik film that I really, really adore, that similarly deals with these very deep social issues. In this case, it's about climate change and the environment, but also about PTSD of veterans who've come back from war, and the impossibility of any one person fixing that. I think all of us crying together, we're crying about that, right? So that's kind of like your experience too. It's the experience of crying about something we feel powerless to really, really solve.
We've got a clip from Without a Trace from 2018, because you gave us a heads up. Here's a listen.
Sorry for making you worry about me. If we had a phone, it could have called you.
Always been able to communicate without all that.
I think it might be easier on us if we try to adapt.
We're wearing their clothes, we're in their house, we're eating their food, we're doing their work. We have adapted. The only place we can't be seen is in this house.
Without a Trace from 2018, a crying movie. And Jocelyn, I understand there's a genre of movie targeted at making people cry called women's weepies. Can you tell the history of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the really kind of golden moment for women's weepies, which are also women's films, or they're a subset of melodramas, it's really in the 1930s and 1940s, and then further into the 1950s. 30s and 40s are kind of the high point for these films. They're also called three handkerchief movies, if that gives you a little insight into how much you're supposed to cry. So these were very much melodramas, but they're told from the perspective of women. Right. And that's what kind of distinguished them from other melodramas or other kind of romantic movies you might see at the time. And not only were they from the perspective of a woman, they're also about the kind of social constrictions that women face at this point, right? Like the things that they could not do, the fatalism of their position as kind of second-class citizens in society, also relationships between mothers and daughters, which is something that was always used to kind of to kind of swell up those emotional moments. So some of the most famous ones are things like Stella Dallas, the Barbara Stanwyck film, directed by King Vidor in 1937. At the end, Barbara Stanwyck is standing outside her daughter's wedding, just like weeping her eyes out, but she's also happy for her. And that's the moment, you know, when everybody's raising their hankies up. Or something like Now Voyager with Betty Davis. Betty Davis was a big star of women's movies and women's weepies. Films like Imitation of Life, the earlier one from the 1930s with Claudette Colbert, and then Douglas Sirk's remake of Imitation of Life in 1959. So a lot of these were kind of made for a similar, for us to cry, but for similar reasons to what you and I were just talking about, Rob, which is the horrors of these larger social problems that we cannot solve. And this was really the first time that Hollywood was making films that were directed at women and at women's problems.
Talking to Jocelyn Sapaniak Gillies, film expert at UW-Milwaukee, talking about the movies that make us cry. And you can tell us what movie makes you cry at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Karen is with us in Oshkosh. Karen, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. She mentioned Imitation of Life, the 1959 version, and I can come in the last 20 minutes of that movie and start crying. It is, it's one of my favorite crying movies, and even the last 20 minutes, that's all I had to see is the last 20, and I am bawling.
And Karen, I've heard this from other people too. No matter how many times you've seen it and you know what's coming, obviously you know, even if you can come in the last 20 minutes, it still hits you like that, right?
It really does. It's a mother-daughter thing. It's two single moms, a white mother and a black mother, both struggling. The white mother becomes a famous movie star or theater star, and the black mother stays with her throughout her life as a maid, a companion, and there's, you know, love triangles, and the daughter of the black woman can pass for white and tries to and rejects her mother, and then mother dies and the girl is grief stricken. And that's when the waterworks start.
Karen, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, that maybe that particular story is universal, but Jocelyn, that kind of family drama and loss of loved ones, there are some universal elements in there.
There really are. I just love the way that that Karen, you described all of the different intricacies of the structures of that film, because you've got these intimate relationships between mothers and daughters. You've got the intimate female friendships too, but then you've got these larger social problems. Problems around a racist society, right? Problems around how do single mothers navigate trying to make money and trying to exist in a society that's quite unfriendly to them. So it's both this combination of intimacy and then the real sadness of how do we combat things that seem just completely beyond our control. It's a great example.
Thanks a lot for the call, Karen. We'll go to Bruce now in Waterford. Bruce, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
All right, what's your movie, Bruce?
My Girl. My absolute favorite movie. And wow, talk about a tearjerker.
Is that one? So do you go back and watch it knowing it's going to make you cry?
Oh, absolutely. I go back and watch it knowing it's going to make me cry. That's part of what I love about it, actually. It's just so much about tragic loss, not even that it's the loss of a child, although that's really a heavy thing to take. But, you know, these friends, and then there's this sudden, unexpected loss. And anyone who's dealt with that, I think, can identify.
Bruce, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Jocelyn, what do you think?
Yeah, I think so much of that, too, is about the loss of what it was to be a child, right? Like, nostalgia can also make us cry because we're no longer those people that we once were when we were children. And, you know, when I was younger, that was the movie that, like, so many of my friends cried to. It was all, you couldn't even talk about My Girl without, like, girls bursting into tears.
Bruce, thank you so much for joining in. We're talking to Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor of English and Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee, talking about the movies that make us cry. You can share yours, if you're willing, at 800-642-1234. What is a movie you've watched while cried while watching or watched while crying? I guess let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor of English and Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee, looking at the movies that make us cry. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jocelyn, before we go back to our callers, we asked around here at WPR. Michelle Good, a board up on our show, also behind the Chapter a Day program, says, "It didn't make me cry, but the only movie I ever saw my dad cry at was Field of Dreams. Then I saw it again with my boyfriend at the time. He was sobbing, too." And then we hear sometimes, Jocelyn, about the guy movies that make him cry. Brian's Song, I think, is the universal make the guy cry movie. We talked earlier about women, movies, and crying. How about the guys?
Yeah, there's a really fantastic film scholar named Tanya Modaleski, who used to actually teach in Wisconsin, although she's now no longer in Wisconsin. But she's written about male, what she calls male weepies, right? It's like a version of the women's weepies that we talked about earlier. And she often points to Clint Eastwood. Like, Clint Eastwood movies are like designed to make men cry. But I think it's also baseball movies, right? Field of Dreams is one, partially because it's about that father-son relationship, compared to the women's weepies, which often are about mother-daughter relationships. But the one that I always think about is The Natural, because that's the one that I saw my dad cry to so many times when I was younger. Something about baseball movies. I can't answer that one, but...
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Carrie is on the line in Eau Claire. Carrie, what is your movie?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's The Notebook. Many years ago, when people still rented VHS tapes, my husband, who was then my boyfriend, rented The Notebook. I had never seen it. We got almost all the way through the movie, and when the main character couldn't remember her husband anymore, it just slayed me. I got up and I couldn't watch it anymore. I went and took a shower and I was bawling, and he's like, "You have to watch the end of it." And it was such a moving ending and such a sweet love story. It's an awesome movie.
Did that help bring you together? You were a boyfriend, girlfriend, yes. Then now husband and wife.
I'm so glad I watched the end, because when she couldn't remember him and she got so combative because she had Alzheimer's, I mean, it was crushing. It makes me tear up right now.
Oh, Carrie, thank you for sharing that one. Jocelyn.
Yeah, The Notebook was one of the ones that I had written down in my notes for today as a kind of contemporary version of these weepies. I mean, that is one that I think is guaranteed to make its audiences cry, partially because, again, it's about the sense of loss, but the powerlessness that comes from that sense of loss. And I think that's really a common thread that we're talking about here today, that crying while watching a movie is about crying over our lack of power in a situation or inability to change something that has been fated.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Carrie. Dennis joins us next in Two Rivers. Dennis, hello.
Hi. When my parents were in hospice care, and after they died, a hospice counselor recommended watching movies about loved ones dying and people preparing to die as a form of therapy.
Did you try that? Did it work for you, Dennis? Did it help?
Yeah, it helped somewhat. And what also you mentioned about Chapter a Day, the book by Melma Skyman, Sit, Stay, Heal, that helped quite a bit too, because it was about a mother dying and about trying to connect with a father. So as far as Chapter a Day, that helped too. So that goes for Michelle Good also. So.
I'll pass that on to Michelle. Dennis, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Jocelyn, I hear sometimes about, you know, people who read fiction are able to develop empathy skills sometimes in life. It sounds like Dennis and this person at the hospice thought movies about a tough situation that you're dealing with can help you deal with them yourself. I hadn't heard that before.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, is that not what art is supposed to do for us, right? Mm-hmm. Art is supposed to give us the tools, but also the solace to deal with these events in our lives that are so intimate and so universal at the same time. So we can almost think about these kinds of films that make us cry as practice for dealing with the kinds of emotions we might encounter in real life and how to have empathy for others who are going through the same thing.
Dennis, thanks again for sharing that. Roy joins us next, calling from Illinois. Roy, hello.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for letting me call in. The movie that I absolutely have both eyes are pouring with tears at the end of it is The Green Mile with Tom Hanks. and John Green, and it's about solitary confinement and being faced with the reality that of death, and also the character, the main character in the movie, he had a healing power, which ultimately came to the conclusion that he was still on death row with a date to die, but he they found out that he was innocent. They found out that the real man was in solitary confinement, and that they still had to put a man to death that everyone knew was innocent, and how it was an honorable mention of death, but it was a way of dealing with a thing that we are most afraid to talk about.
Roy, wow, great summary of The Green Mile. Jocelyn, I imagine this might be a common one for people to cry at.
Yeah, I think so. I think also of The Shawshank Redemption, right, which is another kind of prison film that incites a lot of tears. But similarly, right, it's about these relationships and these friendships, which are so intimate, but it's also about the impossibility of our attempts to consider what it means to have a kind of prison industrial complex, right? And our powerlessness in the face of how that structure has become so overblown, so massive, something that we don't even know how to deal with anymore. And art helps us to begin to think about how we might dismantle it or all of the problems that we encounter with it, and maybe to come up with a new kind of solution, maybe by crying.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies from UW-Milwaukee, film professor there, looking at the movies that make us cry. Back to your calls now. Ravi is with us in Brookfield. Ravi, hello.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for responding. This about the movie I saw was very pathetic, was The Brave One by Jodie Foster. She's walking with her husband and with four dogs, and then suddenly they let loose the dogs, and then there's no sound coming from the dogs barking. So they go rush to the place. What happened to our dogs? And all the dogs were on the floor dead. Mm. And then when they turned around, they saw four people standing there with guns and killed all the dogs. And then she asked, why would you do like that to the animals? They are very innocent. And they take the gun, and the husband is asking, they shoot the husband to death, Jodie Foster's husband. Mm. And she escapes from there, runs, and then she takes revenge. What it is that when you lose the most important person, your husband or a boyfriend who's been so close to you, and the sadness it creates, it reminded me of my older brother in India, where he died, and he and I are the best friends that we could have ever been, my own elder brother. And our wife still continues to live with one son who has grown up now, but she would just keep quiet, and she would never show the sadness in her eyes. And she's still single, and she's unmarried. She loved my brother just like the way I loved him too. So it's kind of when you lose such I'm a doctor, I'm a physician myself. Even for me to understand sadness, it's so difficult, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So we all have to be in love with each other to understand sadness during death.
Ravi, I'm sorry I have to jump in. We're just about out of time. But Jocelyn, that he felt that direct connection between this movie and this personal tragedy in his own life.
Oh my God, that was the most touching call and the most touching story. I'm going to cry right now talking about it. That was so beautiful, but I think it tells us so much about not only how films teach us to have empathy for one another, which is one of the most important aspects of storytelling, right? It's one of the things that like draws us towards stories as human beings, right? But also how we're able to recognize our own struggles in the struggles we see depicted in art. It really speaks to how film is still a kind of universal language.
Ravi, thanks again for calling in and sharing that with us. And Jocelyn, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks so much. I love being on. It's great to talk to you, Rob.
You too. That's Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor of English and Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. She's the author of the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship, and Modernized American Theater Architecture. We talked about the experience of crying while watching movies, and there is still time for you to keep sharing the movie that makes you cry. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's the Ideas Network Facebook page. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. If we get enough of them, I'll share some of them over the course of the rest of the week. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the author of the new book, We're Not Broken, shares stories of life with autism and says we need to change the conversation from fixes and cures to mutual understanding. and we'll dig deep into the science of sweat, why it's salty, why it's smelly, and other mysteries of perspiration. We'll meet the author of the new book, The Joy of Sweat. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Have you ever dreamed of living on Mars? Here's your chance, and the commute won't be as long as you might think. NASA is looking for Mars volunteers for a simulation of life on our red neighbor. As reported in Science Alert, NASA put out a call for volunteers to live in a simulation of a Mars ground station for a year. That would be the first of three scheduled year-long projects. Now, before you get too excited, make sure you meet all the guidelines. They are looking for healthy people aged 30 to 55 who are U.S. citizens or permanent residents. Got to have a master's degree in a related STEM field and 2 years of professional experience or at least 1,000 hours of pilot-in-command time on a jet aircraft. Plus, there's the NASA long-duration flight astronaut physical test. So, okay, I'd have to stretch my resume just a bit and probably get an exercise program going. Plus, I'd have a hard time hosting this show from the simulation project at Johnson Space Center in Houston. So I'm out, but that leaves room for you if you meet all those requirements and have a year to spare. If you're in, get that application to NASA by September 17th and have your bags packed for the project next fall. Let us know. We'll want to talk to you afterward. Space news you can use. This is Central Time.